So after this fourth session today, we will have a drinks reception where we have coffee just now. And for the fourth session, we have Daniel Pfeiffer from the University of Sheffield, and his paper is titled On Following Orders to Harm the Innocent. And we will hear the response by Ludwig Beckmann from the University of Stockholm.
Thank you. Thank you also for inviting me here, the organizers, Jonathan and Helen. Yes, I'm not going to summarize the paper since I expect that everyone has had a chance to read it, but I just say that it's summarized. The main claim that is that it's about, or the main claim, the main theme, that it's about possible justifications of the claim that public officials have moral duties to obey orders that they know will cause harm to innocent people. And you have a dual claim there, a dual sort of aim with the paper. One is to identify the structure of any solution or answer to that question, and another one is to offer a particular argument that you think will help us to answer that. So I will give a few comments here on this paper, and I counted them to five, but I don't know. I mean, there are many sub-questions and so forth, so I don't know. And I'm not sure I've sort of sorted them in this sort of logical order, but I try to make it sensible, as good as I can, anyway. The first question I wanted to discuss was the case here. I mean, you start with a general discussion, general problem of public officials and their moral duties to obey harmful commands or harmful orders. Then, however, the discussion quickly focuses on the special case where the prison warden and the moral duties of the prison warden to imprison or implement the punishment on someone he or she knows is innocent, who is not guilty for the crime that he or she has been convicted for. And I was thinking a little bit about the relationship here between that specific case of the prison warden and the general problem here of the problem that is more general, namely that political when or if public officials have moral duties to obey harmful commands. You get back to this relationship between the specific problem and the general problem, the particular and general, by the end of the paper. So, I mean, this is something you do discuss. But I thought perhaps you could say something more about this. And one way to approach this question, that I focus on, is by looking at different notions of orders. Because there is something specific here with the kind of order that the prison ward is subject to in relation to the court. When the court issued an order to implement the punishment on this person, well, that is an order that is directed to a specific individual. It's valid for a specific individual, and it's based on a rather thorough, I would assume, investigation of the merits of the case. But you can think about orders in bureaucracies or in public institutions that are of different kinds. For instance, orders that are communicated without a thorough investigation, that are quite sort of based on a sort of very brief judgment, for instance, by a police officer, and he's ordering one of his sub-constables to intervene in some very specific situation. It's not an order that has the same kind of status, or is at least not of the same kind. But still, it might be an order in that case that is directed to and is valid only for that specific situation and valid also for a specific person. Then we can think of more general orders, like legal rules that are, or general commands made by a public authority that are valid for everyone working in that authority. For instance, social workers are obeying a lot of orders, implicitly or explicitly, when they are dealing with their patients and in different situations. So we have different kinds of orders here, depending on how general they are and how well sort of. To the extent that they are based on a sort of investigation of the case. My point here is, I mean, the arguments you offer and the analysis you offer are all concerned with this specific case where orders are to individual cases and based on thorough investigations. How well do they translate your arguments to these other kinds of orders? And is that something you could, I mean, if we are interested in the general problem here and not just the prison ward example. Wouldn't it have been interesting then to sort of discuss different kinds of relationships between individual public officials and the public authority that they are obeying? So that's just, I mean, one way of asking you. I mean, I don't have an argument for exactly what the answer would be to that question. Yeah, let's go on. A second thing I was wondering about is one other specific aspect of the case here that which you don't mention, I think, but that seems immediately sort of or potentially at least normatively relevant, is access to remedies for the person who is innocent but still subject to punishment by the public official. I mean, one sort of very simple and immediate sort of reaction you would have to this case that you present here, and you have five different conditions that are characterizing this case of the prison warden, is that, well, why should he be worried about whether he's punishing this innocent person or not when there's a possibility of appeal from that person? Wouldn't that sort of relieve him from any sort of, at least, moral duties? It would be permissible for him to follow these orders, since he's following the orders is not sort of determining finally the situation for this for C here. This is the person who is innocent. He can appeal and everything can be fine. And also, isn't that then something, the degree to which sort of legal remedies are available to the people subject to the public officials following orders, that could of course vary somewhat along different situations and different kinds of cases, perhaps depending on the nature of the legal system and so forth. And wouldn't that be sort of a consideration that would be normatively relevant in general also when we should address this fundamental problem that you are discussing here? So, third, I was thinking about the structural point here, which is, I think, the main and most interesting most plausible, I think, claim that you make here, or argue for, namely that if we want to justify the moral duty of public officials to obey orders, even if they harm the innocent, then we must account for those moral duties in terms of the interest of the people who are actually affected by or subject to those the treatment. And I think that sounds very sound. But still, there are some questions you can ask about this. And one is also something that you bring up here, and that seems to, because it seems to depend a little bit on the nature of the kind of punishment that is implemented. Capital punishment, for instance. It seems, for instance, obviously awkward to say that, well, it's the major interest of the person who is innocent but subject to punishment when subject to capital punishment is that he or she is subject to a person that is more interested in obeying orders in order to avoid excessive punishment than avoid being executed. That seems sort of obviously, and you that's what you actually are saying a little bit, but so you see that. But what does that say about this argument and the validity of that argument? I mean, it seems to be the case that we can only appeal to the C, if you call him the C, there's the innocent person, C's interest in public officials obeying orders so long as C is not subject to grave moral harm or something. There seems to be sort of a moral condition for when that interest takes precedence over other interests of C. And you don't sort of dwell on that a lot. You don't sort of specify what that sort of threshold might be and how we might formulate it. But it seems like unless we do that, unless we try to specify where that threshold is, this argument will become, run the risk of becoming rather hollow, that, well, so long as it's not very, very nasty, we have an interest that people obey the orders that they are given. But of course, if it's very nasty orders, then we don't have an interest in that. That's our, yeah. So, and there's also another presupposition here of your argument, that these courts enacting those, or making those convictions, and ordering those punishments are legitimate courts. That's the sort of expression you use here, legitimate courts. And I wasn't sure here whether we should understand that in a narrower or in a broader sense. I mean, in a narrow sense, that would mean that the court is functioning all right. It's a fair court. But it doesn't necessarily imply that the court is part of a political and legal system that is itself just, and where the laws are proportionate, and where there are no sort of discrimination in the police corps or whatever. I mean, so we could say that in a narrow sense, it's just that the court hasn't committed any sort of serious legal wrong when they made the legal judgment. But if we think about it in broader terms, well, then we might think about sort of the justice of the entire political and legal system. And I wonder here what sort of is the normative sort of relevance of that. I mean, could we say that even people who are sentenced by a court that is narrowly legitimate, they have a sort of, the major interest is just that public officials and the prison wards obey the orders, and not even though they know that the laws and the rest of the political system may be discriminatory or unjust? Or is this a sort of a judgment that is premised on some thicker and more demanding notion of legitimacy here? So that's one question. Moving on, I was also thinking about, I mean, the way you characterize this problem to certain, some aspects. You frequently talk about the prison ward as the person who is punishing the innocently convicted person. But I wonder if that is sort of a correct or adequate or appropriate way to picture the situation here. I mean, the court doesn't order an individual, of course, prison ward to implement the decision. It orders the organization, the authority, which is in charge of prisons and which is in charge of the penal part of the legal system to implement those things. So there are lots of people involved here. And the problem is, the question then arises, how to what extent are individual prison wards, prison workers, at all responsible for the implementation of the punishment? I mean, is it reasonable to say that the extent to which they follow orders or not is decisive at all for the extent to which people are subject to punishment? I mean, of course, you can say that they are individually sort of complicit within to it, but I mean, are they the ones who are implementing the punishment individually? I find that just sort of well, obviously problematic to say. What else? The further question was with one of the assumptions that is playing a large role in your argument, namely the rights of C, the rights here of innocent people convicted by a court. And you say that, well, if C is not liable to suffer imprisonment because C hasn't done anything, well, then other has duties not to imprison C, and so C has the right not to be intentionally imprisoned because C is innocent. And I was wondering if I mean, that sounds very intuitive, sounds reasonable, but you know, I wonder if that's, is that really right? I mean, first, you can, I think you can move in two directions here. Either it's too weak, another one is that it's too strong. And I think, of course, the too weak version is that, well, what is sort of particular with your way of formulating the right here of C is that it's only a right against being intentionally imprisoned if C is innocent. So, for instance, you wouldn't say that the court is violating the rights of C. Of course, this court is not intentionally harming C because knowing that he is or she is innocent. The court is trying its best to find out whether she is innocent or not, and they make a sort of foreseeable and excusable mistake here. They just happen to, so they're not intentionally trying to harm someone that is innocent. And that is what, in your analysis, distinguished the court from the prison ward, I thought. But I mean, I was wondering here, why wouldn't C's right be just not being imprisoned if innocent? Whether, even if it wasn't an intentional act on behalf of the person making the decision. So that's one thing. So perhaps one version would be then to say that, well, if C has a right here, that right should be stronger than the way you put it. On the other hand, you might say that, well, given that judicial systems, as you point out, will always be imperfect, they will always happen to sometimes free guilty people and sometimes imprison innocent people. If you want to think that the rights people have should be consistent with the way we organize our public institutions, well, then we can't say that people have this sort of basic right to not being imprisoned when they're innocent. What they have a right to is rather a right to a fair trial. They have a right to be treated equally and fairly by the legal system or the penal system and the criminal justice system and so forth. And that is all there is to it. But the problem, of course, if we say that, well, then of course, the entire problem, as you have specified it, will sort of just disappear. There wouldn't be a problem here. The prison ward wouldn't no longer be facing a sort of moral problem here. But there is also... Yeah, and then moving further then, we come to your argument here. What I think is your argument. Namely that the... what?
You'll see.
C's interest here, and the interest of C that actually justifies P obeying the orders, or having a moral duty even to obeying the orders, is to avoid excessive punishment here. And you can avoid excessive punishment when you're treated by the criminal justice system, or by when you're imprisoned, at least, more securely, if you know that the people handling you are not handling you on the basis of their sense that you are guilty, but only because of the legal fact that you're convicted. So, it's in our interests, when we are dealt with by the penal system, that the officers, the public officials there, are perceiving us as sort of just legal, subject to sort of legal conviction, and not sort of, they don't attribute moral qualities to us anyway. Well, fine. But the question here is, do we have reasons to assume that the innocent people treated by the subject to punishment have the same interest as the guilty people treated by the penal system? I mean, surely both have an interest in avoiding excessive punishments. I mean, even if whether you're innocent or guilty, you would have an interest in not being subject to excessive punishments from the legal system. But on the other hand, those who are innocent, they would have an additional interest to not being in prison at all, which the guilty would not have. I mean, they would, perhaps they can think they have a preference, of course, not being in prison, but they can't have a sort of a reasonable interest in that. So, I mean, so why should we think that, how can we say that for those who are innocent, that they're most important in, what is the basis for your conclusion, that their most important interest is rather to avoid excessive punishment than not being a sort of innocently punished at all? And I was thinking that this dual sort of, this complexity of thinking about different kinds of interest of different groups of inmates or groups of people in prisons can just be avoided if would be more straightforwardly sort of dealt with if you just say that, well, the interest of anyone who is subject to punishment is just to have a fair trial. That is the interest they have. And of course, and interested in they have an interest in being treated fairly. And that accounts for both, I think, the interest they have in relation to the court and the interest they have in relation to the prison wards, namely that they should not either be subject to excessive punishments. So it's the same interest that we all have. But of course, the costs of admitting that is that this problem is becoming different. So, finally, you also... I was thinking about the characterization of this problem. I thought about it when I read the end of the paper where you discuss this exclusionary reasons, where the court's orders should be considered as exclusionary reasons by the prison ward, so that they should take precedence from it. Would exclusionary reasons in the sense that they would be second order reasons that obliterates or trumps the first order reasons that the prison ward would have. But what you say here is that but the thing is, let me put it like this. There are two ways of characterizing the problem here. One is to say that, do these exclusionary reasons that the court communicates, are they undermined by the truth of the belief that the penal officer have that she is innocent? Does the validity of these exclusionary reasons lose? I mean, is it undermined? Do they lose their exclusionary property by the fact that the prison ward knows for true and has a true belief that C is innocent? Is that the way you characterize the problem? Or is it this way, namely that does the exclusionary reasons communicated by the court, do they justify punishing innocent people? Is it morally justified to punish an innocent person just because, for P here, just because those orders were directed by the court and those reasons should be considered by him as exclusionary? And it struck me that, well, of course, we don't have to conclude that, or potentially at least, we don't have to conclude that punishing an innocent person is morally justified in order to admit that the court's reasons might be serve as exclusionary reasons for the prison ward. Because what the prison ward have is a reason. And the question is, should he act on his reason or should he act on the court's reasons? And if you think about it in those terms, well, he should act on the court's reasons, because those are exclusionary reasons, because the court has an authority, is an authority. But that doesn't sort of eliminate the fact that, well, C is innocent. And, of course, that is a moral wrong happening here. I mean, because the fact of innocence of... What I'm trying to say is that the fact of innocence is not the same as the belief that C is innocent. And you could say that it's illegitimate to act with belief of C's innocence in certain context without sort of, well, denying that C's innocence represents a sort of moral problem. And I was thinking about whether that is something that disappears a little bit in your analysis. I think that is it.
Thank you. There was a lot to take in, very helpful. So let me go through these comments. I won't go through them one by one because there would be enough time then, maybe to deal with some other issues. But so let me quickly consider what I think might be some of the more important issues. So you ask how we should think, and this is a kind of general methodological question, so how should we think, say, of the case of capital punishment? Right? So you raise this, and this is your third question. How does the story I tell, which grounds the duty of obedience that the prison warden has, in the interest of, if you will, the victim, how does that apply in cases like capital punishment? And as I say in the paper, I suspect it doesn't apply in the case of capital punishment, because I suspect the interest the victim would have in the prison wardens having the relevant duty just isn't, if you're sufficiently strong, to outlaw whatever interest the victim has in just being released in the case where he's in fact innocent. Now, what I take it this entails for the kind of argument I want to offer is that it might follow from my argument that certain kinds of punishments are not compatible with the kind of system we have where punishment is inflicted in our name by public officials, who, if you will, we think ought to be able to do so without losing their moral integrity, without acting immorally. Right? So it might turn out that my argument, while it simultaneously provides some rational reconstruction of something like the system that we have, a system that involves a division of labor of the sort that I describe, also has some actual substantive upshots for the kinds of punishments that can legitimately be imposed. That is, be imposed without violating what I think of the requirements of moral compatibility that I would want to apply to any institutional design of a system of punishment. And you ask at another point, what exactly the threshold is, or the cut-off point. So I might want to say this about capital punishment, what do I want to say about various other kinds of cases. I don't trust my own moral intuitions about the difference between 10 years and 20 years and 5 years enough to feel like I have any kind of anything particularly useful to say here. But certainly, if it turns out that what I say about capital punishment extends to 20 years in prison or 10 years in prison, then I think there would also be a reason for thinking we couldn't have the kind of system of capital of punishment that we have while inflicting the severe punishment that we currently frequently inflict on people. So that is something I'm perfectly content with, which reflects, if you will, the broader aspiration of the paper, which is in part to offer what you might think of as a rational reconstruction of an existing practice. And it's, in a way, an open question whether it's possible to do this. I started writing this paper, and I'm still, if you're open-minded, or sufficiently open to the idea, that there might not be a successful rational reconstruction of the system that we have. I think what I'm offering is, if you're the best reconstruction I could come up with, but if it turns out that that doesn't justify the system we actually have, but only another system that requires revisions or change from our current system, that's all, if you're fine with me. I'm not committed to the system we have. I think that'd be crazy, given how bad the system is that we have. Just looking at the next couple of questions. So I think you're right to say I talk about legitimate courts, but I don't distinguish. I don't say a lot about them. And I was trying to sidestep this, but I think you're right to say there's a genuine question how we should think about the difference between broad and narrow legitimacy. That is, between the case where just the court is doing all it's meant to be doing, but the background system itself might not be, and the system, if you will, the background system too, lives up to whatever the relevant ideals are. Now, I had assumed, more or less, the latter case, so broad legitimacy, where the background system too satisfies all of the relevant legitimacy conditions, because my thought is, even in that case, there are going to be instances where somebody is convicted of a crime he did, in fact, commit, but it was perfectly all right for the criminal law to prohibit this kind of action. The kind of punishment the criminal law imposes is the right kind of punishment had he in fact committed this kind of action, etc. So that was the case I was focusing on. I think what you brought out usefully is, but hang on, the positive argument I offer, that is the argument about the interest the prisoner may have in the prison wardens having the relevant duty of obedience, might in a way have interesting effects once we focus on cases of narrow legitimacy. So once we focus on cases where maybe some of the background institutions are not fully legitimate, but somewhat unjust. Because it might still turn out that it's better from the point of view of the victim, the prisoner, if the people inflicting the punishment are doing so with the same detached attitude that I described when I tried to motivate this line of thought. And I think that's the thing I need to think about more. My initial reaction is, so I think that might very well be true. I think it's going to make a difference that the background system is legitimate, because it's going to entail, I think, that there's going to be a larger range of cases where somebody has, if you will, an interest in just being released than they would have maybe in some of these other kinds of cases I'm talking about. And so that might change the trade-off between the relevant interests we have on each side. The interest in if you're being treated one way if you're in prison versus the interest of just if you're having your imprisonment, if you're second-guessed by another party. But it certainly is the case that it seems to me the kind of argument I offer might entail that there are going to be cases where, even though the background system is illegitimate, the prison warden ought not to second guess it. And I wonder whether that's the problem I should worry about. That's something I shouldn't be happy about. I need to think, yeah, that's, I think, a really good point. I need to think more about that. Just quickly about the question of C's right. So I think we suggested it might be too weak, but I think that required that rested on a particular reading of the right that I think wasn't the reading I intended. So I think you read it as saying the other person has a duty not to intentionally imprison the innocent, where that if you're the intentionally covered the whole of the parentheses imprisoning the innocent. Right? I don't think that's how we usually think of it. That is, if you intentionally imprison me, and I'm in fact innocent, then you violated my right. You don't have to know that I'm innocent. It seems to me if you're... the criminal lawyers in the room can correct me. I think the mens rea requirement wouldn't extend to your belief that that I'm innocent or not. So the fact that you intentionally imprison me, that's relevant here. It seems to me, certainly morally speaking, that's the correct thing to say, however the criminal justice system would deal with this. Now, I think the other question, whether C's right is too strong, as I'm putting it here, I don't have a very strong argument against this. I have a strong intuition that that can't be right. I have a weak argument why it can't be right. Now, the weak argument why it can't be right is the following. As you yourself say, the alternative to my having the right not to be imprisoned as an innocent person would be, at minimum, a right to a fair trial, suitably specified. Now, suitably specified here is going to include, I assume, I think it has to include, reference to my innocence. That is, it has to be the kind of trial that does a reliable job, again, specified in some way, tracking my innocence as opposed to my and my guilt, right? Now, it seems to me if I have a right to that, that has to be because I have an interest in not being in prison if I'm innocent, right? But if I have an interest in not being in prison if I'm innocent that grounds my right to a fair trial, I have a hard time seeing why that wouldn't also ground my interest in not being in prison if I'm in fact innocent in the kind of cases. And it's important to recognize that this is not going to be, that this is going to affect how we want to think about the kinds of case pleasure that I'm talking about, right, where I'm fairly convicted, duly convicted, but I'm in fact innocent. In the following way, it seems to me, and I actually think intuition is here on my side, it does seem to me that somebody who's been duly convicted but who's in fact innocent, and whose conviction is later discovered to have been mistaken, is morally entitled to some form of restitution. That is, there's some kind of wrong that was committed against him. Now, your view, it seems to me, has a hard time making sense of that, right? Because after all, he was duly convicted, it was all fair, etc., etc. So it seems to me, if one has the institution of restitution appropriate here, that suggests at least that there was a right that was set back by the imprisonment of this person. All right, I think I'm almost done. So the very last point, the question of the validity of the exclusion of reason. So I'm not sure I quite got your objection there. The thought is this, right? So the state claims to have imposed on me an exclusionary reason of a certain sort, and a reason that requires me to act on its determination of the victims of C's guilt or punishment, rather than act on my own judgment of the matter. Now, I don't want to say there could never be, that's the point, right? I don't want to say there could never be such an exclusionary reason, but the entire question has to be, well, granted that if I had that exclusionary reason, I would be, and it in fact excludes my own assessment it excludes the right the person otherwise has against being imprisoned, I would be justified in imprisoning him, right? He would be wronged. He wouldn't be wronged by me. I would in fact be justified in doing this. He would be wronged. But the entire question is, well, is there such a reason that would justify my doing it? That, in a way, seems to me the challenge, right? The question, if you're first personally speaking, as the prison warden, is how can I possibly be justified in inflicting this kind of harm on a person whom I know to be innocent, right? And that's, in a way, the structure of the problem as I see it. And so this is why the question is precisely the validity of that exclusionary reason, and the question is precisely what, you know, in a lot of the cases where a lot of the standard attempts to justify the exclusionary reason seem to me to not actually establish its validity because it's not compatible with background commitments we have about various other kinds of values and reasons. So.